My name is Rod C. Davis, and I have James M. Fedak, Sr. of Shelton, Connecticut with me. How are you, James?
How are you, Rod?
I'm great, thanks. James and I go back many years, and he's had a near-death experience that we're going to be talking about. And this isn't the first time James is sharing this experience with me. And I really appreciate the fact that he's even willing to let me record his experience to share with others on my website. Thank you very much, James.
Rod, it's a question that I believe is on everybody's mind. It was always on my mind about what happens to us after we die.
You hit the nail right on the head. It is on everybody's mind. I really appreciate your willingness to take your time and help. At my prompting, James has told me about his near-death experience several times over the years, and it's had an impact on me every single time. I have to tell you that even though this happened quite a few years ago, his accounting of his experience has never changed. I can vouch for that because I have written record of what he told me, word for word, that goes back many years. Jim, what year did you have your near-death experience, and what brought it about?
It was that I was a victim of the Audi motor car incident where they were had a defect with Audi automobiles. They were telling us that we were putting our foot on the gas and not on the brake, and these cars just took off. So when that was what prompted the accident that I was in to get, to the point where I had an after-death experience in the hospital. And that, I was in that accident, I'll never forget it, I'll never forget the whole deal, was October 3rd, 1983, and it happened at 10:22 a.m.
And as I recall, it happened right near the Trumbull Mall.
It did. Yes, it happened right in the Trumbull, but right outside the Trumbull Mall. I basically was coming out of the main entrance on the Main Street exit, and when I came up to the traffic light, the car—it was a brand new car, 186 miles it had on it—and it started to stumble a little bit, like so. It was an Audi 5000S, a four-door, and I put it into neutral. It had a gear shift on the floor. It was like a floor-mounted gear shift. And I put it into neutral, and I raced it a little bit, and it seemed to quiet right out. And then the light turned green, and I just put it back into drive, and bam, this thing took off. And I'm talking about, they were pretty fast cars. So when it took off, I either had to make a left and go up Main Street or a right and go down Main Street. I went the way I was supposed to. The first instant that it came on like that, I thought something happened with the cruise control. Okay, because I had used the cruise control. Not in the parking lot, but before I went up to the mall, I had used the cruise control. And that was the first thing that came into my mind. Yet, it happened so fast. This thing is gaining speed, and all of a sudden, here comes this UPS truck that I saw out of the corner of my eye backing out of this driveway, and bam! The next thing, it was a big flash of light. That's all it was. And then the next thing...
When you say a big flash of light, is that when you had your near-death experience?
No, that was just when I got into the accident. Okay, no.
And what do you mean by a big flash of light, Jim?
Almost like a lot of photographers around you, and they all had flash bulbs or whatever in their camera, and it was like all at once. It's just like a big flash, boom.
Huh.
And that was it. And I remember coming awake late that afternoon in the hospital, and I can remember her voice, but I didn't have my glasses on, so I couldn't see her. And she said, "You've been in a bad accident. We're doing everything we can. Just be calm. Save your strength." And it was almost word for word that she said that. And then I passed off again. I passed out again, I guess, or went comatose again.
And then the next thing I remember, you were talking about the after-death experience, of course.
Yes.
So I was in the hospital from early October to a few days before Christmas. Okay? So a lot of things came and went. But what ended up happening was is I came out of that and was, you know, gradually gaining my strength, and they had a lot of operation to do on me. They had three broken bones on the femur bone, two in the upper femur bone that were broke clean, and one in the lower femur bone that was just broke once. They had to take care of that. They had to take care of the hip. I had a rib that was grazed my lung and actually pierced the corner of my heart. I had internal bleeding. What else was wrong with me? Oh, I had some big stitches. Remember the stitches on my face?
No, I don't recall that.
Yeah, I had stitches on my face that they had to take care of. And then I was gaining strength, and then they were trying to get me ready for the operation. Okay, because I had a, you know, I was down a while, you know, I was down a couple of weeks on my back, and yet they still didn't do all this work. I was basically in limbo until they got my strength up, because, you know, they were telling my wife, you ain't making it through 15 hours on the operating table in the condition he's in right now. We got to get him up. So they did that, and then, you know, like I say, the next thing that really pops in my mind is, like I said to you before, we were in a room. I remember them putting me out for the operation. And then the next thing I remember is like a drift. I drifted off of where I was on the table, and then I didn't even get a chance to look around, like, you understand? And the next thing I know, bam, I finally realized what it was, a tunnel of millions and billions of swirling lights, and I was cold, boy, I tell you, I was very cold, and I was being hurled down this tunnel at beyond any speed that I ever knew. I mean, just beyond any... Oh, boy, I'm telling you, Rod. I got to stop for a minute, Rod. I'm still here, Rod. I have to compose myself. I've just had a very, very bad attack, the worst I've ever had in my life. What is going on here?
You had, when you say an attack, you had the... chills again, goosebumps.
Oh my God. Shaking, Rod. I've never had this. What is going on here, Rod?
You're telling something that Spirit wants you to tell. That's what's going on. You're getting major confirmation to it.
Oh my God, Rod, that's terrible. That's the boy. I'll tell you, that's scary. You didn't see the damn ghost.
So this has obviously had a major impact on you.
Tears rolling down my cheeks.
There's got to be something in your memory that. You weren't able to find from a regression that's in your subconscious memory that's bringing back real pleasant memories to make you want to cry, because to me that would just be tears of joy.
Okay, Rod, I'm composed now.
Good.
Wait a minute, just give me another minute or something.
Okay.
It actually takes your breath away, Rod. Do you understand me?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've had some spiritual experiences. They weren't near death. I was very conscious, what you had was far more reaching emotionally than what I had. But I know the depth of a spiritual experience because I've had a few that have been very memorable.
It's subsiding now.
Good.
Rod, that's the worst one I ever went through. And I'm going to tell you something right now. We've got a problem with these interviews. I hope this one takes, buddy, because you got to give me a rest after this one.
Yes, what he means by he hopes this one takes, We did this interview about 2 weeks ago, and when we did it and I went to play the tape back, when he started talking about his near-death experience and getting into the parts that were really, really revealing, the tape went blank. There was absolutely nothing on it, and that is the reason why we're redoing this interview at this point in time. And I really appreciate the fact that Jim has taken the time to do it twice.
Yeah, I even, for the listeners there, I even kind of stiffed Rod because I'm busy at what I do at work, and he's busy at what he does at work, and we must have had 4 or 5 appointments to do this, and it just never got done. Either he couldn't make it, and then he would cancel. Most of the time it was me canceling. And I start, and I think about that, Rod, and I say to myself, you never did that to Rod or anybody else before. Well, you know, it was like, you know, okay, I can do that tomorrow. And you know I'm a businessman. You've worked with me.
Yeah.
You don't understand? We're pretty precise individuals. I'm calmed down now, and I'm going to try and stay calmed down as best as I can here. But I think where we left was that I had just entered the tunnel. I was very cold, and I was the longer I was in the tunnel, the faster I went, it seemed. It went slowly, not too slowly, but it wasn't, you know, it went to high speed real quick, okay? And no noise. And then all of a sudden...
You said no noise?
No, I don't think I had any noise, Rod. No.
But you did have a sensation of movement.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, without a doubt. And that's the point that I'm picking apart right now in my mind. How did I get the sensation of movement without noise? It was because the lights that were swirling were passing me. You understand?
Yes.
Okay. And that's where I got the sensation of the high-speed move. And those lights were like needles of lights. It wasn't like, they were like speckles of lights. They were needles of lights. It was like rockets of lights. They were longer. And that, of course, gives you, not the illusion, I don't want to say, but a forward high-speed travel, because what's happening is these speckles, they were speckles. I can't tell you for how long. And then when the movement was there, it accelerated, went from like, woo, those became elongated. Okay? And I said to myself, I was still cold, but then I don't know what made me notice or realize or whatever you want to call it. Hold on, Rod. Hold on. I'm not back to what I was before because that was scary. Okay, it was like elongated needles of light. And don't ask me how I saw this one light at the end of this tunnel. And by the way, I think I've said this a few times. This tunnel wasn't that big around. It didn't seem to be that big around. You understand what I'm saying to you?
Sure.
It wasn't like massive, you know, like the Holland Tunnel, you know? It was more like a, I don't know, kind of remind me of a, I don't know, like a 8-foot kind of a tunnel that would go under a road that a little creek would go in, you know, almost like it gave me that kind of a sense.
Yeah.
I noticed this light at the end of this tunnel, and it was getting bigger, and I was still cold, but then again, I felt myself getting warmer, and then the light got bigger and bigger, and I can't give you a sense of time. How long did that take? I have no recollection of the time it took. It could have been microseconds, and it could have been hours. I don't know. So what happened was, is this light got bigger
bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I felt warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer. And then all of a sudden, it was like, bam! Like it was like, I was there. I instantly knew, like, the answer of life. Why do we go through all this? What is the answer of life? What is the formula for life? Why are we on this earth? Why are some people crippled? Why are some people blind? Why are some people retarded? Why are some people short, black, white, Hispanic, Asian? Why? I had the answer. I had the answer. And in the same instance of having that answer, I also had the most fantastic, utterly fantastic feeling I have ever had in my... there's nothing that can explain this feeling. Once I became part of this light, I felt like a human, a male... orgasm, which is the most powerful feeling that a male or a female, I guess, can really feel with their body. I know that's, in my book, it is. And times a trillion. Times a trillion. Times 100 billion trillion. I don't know. What's the biggest number I can use?
I have no idea.
I have no idea either. But when they came down and they interviewed me, because I did go through the after-death experience, from, I believe it was the University of Connecticut, and because they have a medical division there, a medical school division there, and they were interested in it. And I remember they were tied up with one of the, either tied up with one of the surgeons or something. I asked the question later on how they got there, but I remember this lady that took the interview. She was gorgeous. And this lady was, she had a slight accent on her. She was blonde. This lady smelled so good. I mean, oh, wow, did this lady smell good. And after, you know, she took all the recording, and it took her a couple of stops because I was really still pretty beat up. And I didn't have the strength to do it all the way through, so they would give me a little rest, and then they would come back, and then it would take another 10, 15 minutes, and then rest in 10, 15 minutes, and finally we got through it. And what happened was, is, you know, I basically said to her what I just said here, and the only other thing that I didn't say here yet is the return trip, which was backwards, but it was nowhere near. It seemed like it took me a lot longer to get there than it did to get back, because something happened to drag me back. And then the next thing I remember hearing is my wife Genevieve screaming at the top of her lungs, "I told you he was a tough SOB. He wasn't gonna die. I told you guys, and here he is. Look at him. He's coming out of it." And so I did, and I came out of it. But back to the interview with the doctor from their department there about the after-death experience, I said to her, I said, "You know, you must look at people like me or like me and say, this guy, boy, what kind of drugs was he doing before he had this, you know, dream, you know what I'm saying, or whatever? Or, you know, was, you know, what, you know, what it is. I mean, I it sounded crazy to me. Imagine, I thought it would sound really crazy to her. In fact, I was reluctant to actually give it, because to me at that particular point, besides the feeling, I didn't know if it was a dream. I didn't know what it was. And she said to me, she said, "You know, everybody kind of asks that question, you know, because I said to her, I said, look, I feel like, you know, that, you know, I'm crazy, you know what I'm saying? And you might think I'm crazy because I came up with this big cockamamie story of where I've been and how I got back." And she said to me, she said, "Look," she said, "I'm going to tell you something right now." She says, "You know, a good percentage, I forget what the percentage was, almost 90 or right close to 90% of the people that go through this phenomena come back, and they sing the same tune as you do." And I said, "Really?" She said, "Oh, yeah." And she said, "Especially the males," she said, "because when they are grabbed by the light, a good majority of them explain the feeling the same way as you did. You know, it was like a climatic feeling, a sexual climatic feeling times 100 billion trillion. And I said, really? I said, it made me feel a lot better. It really did. It made me feel like, you know, what I went through was real. Because she said to me at that point, I remember, she said, you know, what did you people all do that we come out and interview? And I've read other interviews from other subjects throughout the United States and actually all over the world. And she says, you know, this goes true all the way around the world. What did all you people do? Get all together in a big stadium and come up with this story so you all know the story? And then when it happened to you, well, you had the story all set down because you was at the stadium and you heard the speaker.
Didn't I always tell you that, Ron?
No, that's the first time you told me that part.
This is real.
In all the years I've known you, I've never known you to be what I would call a religious person. Let me define religious person for you. A person who went to church every Sunday and did his devotions all the time. You never struck me as being that type of person, or am I wrong?
No, you're right. I'm sorry. I never seen God's way, and everybody has their reasons. If you want me to tell why, I will. If you don't, I won't.
No, it's not important to tell why, but let me ask you a question. Since you've had that experience, how do you view, and let me just call it the other side, where you go through the light, how do you view that versus your belief in not following the ways of the church?
Well, the way that I really believe where we go is, I've kind of thought about it a lot, of course, like anybody would. I believe all life is possibly connected to nature energy. And I think that's where we are returned to. And I think that's a good possibility about what the light is. Or it also could have been, I have two thoughts on that. It also could have been, we're an experiment maybe, I don't know, this is going to sound crazy, we're an experiment that we were put here, and this tunnel, that it seems like a tunnel to me, might not be a tunnel, and we are accelerated in spirit from this planet to the planet, the mother planet, where we originated from.
Okay. I've also thought about that theory, and you and I have never discussed that, so that's, I find that interesting.
In my book, that's kind of a cockamamie theory. I mean, really, think about it, what I just said here. You know, I mean,
it's cockamamie in one way, but there's other publications that I've read that really bring the fact home that that could be a reality. But when we leave this life, this body, and we go to our spirit form, which is what you were in when you went through the light, toward the light, through all those swirling lights towards the light, you were in a spiritual form. That light is the supreme being that created all. But one of the things that you brought home that is important for so many people to know, and it is from you as a person that completely experienced it, that when your body quits working here, you don't quit.
Ever since I went through that experience, and I think we've discussed this a couple of times, you and I, I'm not going to go out and commit suicide, but I do not fear death as I used to.
I hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Everyone, up to that point, you would think about death, and then it's not that you feared it. It is something that you know nothing about because nobody ever went there basically and came back 2 weeks later and said, well, this is what it is. Okay? So you have no idea of what it is except through phenomena like I went through, which I do not believe this, you know, phenomena to me, I went through this experience. I don't care what anybody tells me. I don't care whatever. I personally, James M. Bedak Sr., went through this experience.
I do not believe this was a dream.
I think the important thing is that you realize that there's things that go beyond where we're at right now. And if you had to summarize everything that you've experienced and what you look for going forward, how would you summarize it at this point?
How do I summarize my life and what this thing did to change my life?
Yeah, or did it change your life?
I can now think about death and not have to run away from the thought because I'm afraid. So that is something that really came to me and stuck with me all the way through. And then another thing I started to think about and I processed it into my life, I guess it's the golden rule. Do unto others as you wish them to do unto you. Treat other people the way that you would like them to treat you. And I firmly believe that came after this.
You mentioned one thing that now that you're not afraid to die. I've talked with quite a few people who have that same opinion, but you know they say something. They say, I'm more afraid of living, but I'm not afraid of dying. Not an interesting statement.
It is, and when you said that to me, it reflected on something that I had just said to my wife. I say to her, because this world that we now live in is terrible. Something happens to me, they want to put me on life support systems. No, I don't want to. Let me go. Because where I've been, forget it. I want to go.
I hear you.
I don't want to be here. I'd rather be there. There's nothing here left for me, Mariz. You get a little disgusted with life. And I said to her, I said, I'm not afraid to go. Don't think I'm going to some place that I'm not going to be happy, because I'm going to be real happy. And we kind of discussed it, and she said, because she's a nurse, James, we must write this down and about our both wishes, how I feel about myself, she says. In other words, do I get into a car accident and I'm a vegetable?
Sure, you need to...
vegetable or to turn it off.
Yeah, you need to draw up living wills. That's really important.
Right, and that is something that we're going to do. But that, you know, that you said something in the beginning of this interview, and you said this is something that happened quite a few years ago, and look at how powerful it is in your life, James. And here we are. We're talking, this is 1983 to now. He's 29 years, wait a minute, what is it,
26 years.
26 years later, and it's still on. Rod, this powerful feeling that I went through back in 83, I think we have really put this out on the table. We're also dealing here, I'm an antique car enthusiast, I store antique cars up at a farm that has a history, a paranormal history. And Rod was here visiting me in the summertime. I think it was the summer, wasn't it, Rod?
No, it was in the winter after New Year's.
That's right, Rod. It was the winter because it was cold. Now I remember that. It was. And Rod came, he was here, and I said, come on, let me show you where I keep the cars in the barn. And it's a big, huge farm, about 800-acre farm. It's gorgeous. No, Rod, up there?
It is really pretty.
It looks like you're in Wisconsin, and you never left Connecticut, you know? And so we was in there, and I put up the top, and what we were trying to do is the chop will shrink when it's cold, and when it gets warm, it will expand. And after you replace a top on these Cadillac convertibles or any convertibles, I don't care what they say, they never fit like the factory ones. Okay? So we were trying to get this top to stretch a little bit, and all of a sudden, I'm on the driver's side of the car. Where this Uncle Roo appears is on the passenger side of the car by the passenger door, and all of a sudden, Rod looks at me, and you saw the hair stand up, right?
I didn't so much see the hair stand up as the look on your face.
I knew it was something that brought you to the attention of something's happening here, right?
Yep.
And you said to me, "You're seeing him, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah, he's right to your left." And as soon as you turned, you said, "You take it from there."
When I turned, I didn't see him. I felt cold air. And I just kind of turned and looked back at you and put my arms up to the top of my head and then brought them down in like a sweeping motion. And when I did that, you said I went right through him, and that's when he disappeared.
Rod had kind of taught me something, because the last time I encountered Uncle Rue, it was the only time in the history of Uncle Rue, James M. Fedak Sr., that he moved from the position where he was. And that really scared the heck out of me. I mean, he had me shaking, because he was always at one spot. Everybody saw him at that spot. And I was just coming across the garage. I glanced. He was at that spot. I stopped, and I said to him, "I know who you are, Uncle Rue. Why don't you go to the other side? I know who you are." And then as soon as I said that, he was approximately 15 feet from me, okay? And instantly, he was 1 foot in front of me. And he said, "Oh." and that really, it really shocked me. It scared me, you know? I mean, he was 18 inches in front of me. And I said to him, "I know who you are." You know, I said that to him before he moved. In other words, he was at the old position, and I said, I stopped, I saw him, I said, "I know who you are, Uncle Rue. I know why you're here, Uncle Rue. Go, move on. Move to the other side." I'm pretty sure I said it in that kind of a fashion.
So what happened right after you saw him? What'd you do? And he disappeared when you come right up in front of you.
Well, I didn't have my mobile phone with me that day, because I'd have called you instantly. And I jumped in the truck, closed that place up, came home, and directly called you. I said, "Rod, I got some serious problems in this freaking barn where I keep my cars." I said, we gotta get rid of this guy. I said, I was scared. And then he just calmed me down, and he said, that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to scare you. He's one of them scary ghosts. So the next time, I forgot. Yes, we got to end that. What happened was, as you told me, you said, "Well, look, he's scaring you, and that's where he gets his energy from. The more he scares you, the more energy he can draw off you." And so I said to you, you said the next time he comes, you said, "I want you to sound like angry, forceful type voice, not just regular talking."
Yep, but not angry so much as forceful.
Forceful.
Being in command.
Yes, that was the word. I was searching for words. Being in command. And you said to me, "All you got to say, James, is by the blood in Christ, I command you to leave now." And when I saw that, the next time that I saw him, which wasn't how long was it? 2, 3, 4 days, something like that? It wasn't very long.
No, it wasn't. I don't remember how long.
I called you. I don't remember either, because I did call you.
Yeah.
I told you what happened. And I saw him, and I said it the first time, and I was halfway. I had picked up my level of voice, and maybe for an instant, I didn't think it was working, because he didn't start disappearing, okay? And then halfway through it, the second time, he disappeared. And I haven't seen hide nor hair of him since.
That's good.
But you brought up a point, because I'm going through a construction time here, and like things are not missing, but really misplaced is more the word, that I don't remember putting things there, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And I kept telling you about that, and you said, "Hey, you know, he could be maybe, you know, possibility,
he might have come home with you.
Yeah.
And then you also had this problem in recording. Because, you know, Rod, you said that you tried to record this once. You tried two times that I remember. And both times it was the same deal.
Yeah, when you start talking about certain parts in your near-death experience, it would be blanked out.
You know, it was more than one time that happened to you. I don't know if it was two or three times. I don't know, but I'm relatively sure it was two, that it did happen.
Well, I'll take your word on that.
I kind of remember. Now, you know, we talk about this subject a lot, so
yeah.
Sometimes, you know, your mind gets mushed up because we were talking about it and I didn't know you are recording it. You know, it gets
sure. Mushed up. We should wrap this up, Jim. What parting words would you have listeners that have been in learning from your near-death experience?
When I got to that other side and I got into that light, I knew the answer of life. God, do I wish I could remember that. But I can't. I've struggled with that for 26 years, whatever it is. Can't come up with it. But the only thing that I got to say is, you asked me a question back when, did it change my life? Yeah, it did. One, as a human being, I'm not afraid of death like I used to be, like all humans are. And I know where I'm going. I know it's a great, peaceful, can't be any better in my book. And you said that it changed the way that I live and what I do. And I said, yeah, I think it did. I became more responsive to being a nicer person. Do unto others as you wish them to do unto you. And I from that point on, I saw people in a different light. I really did. And it just changed my perception of people, so to speak. I think I became a nicer guy.
Well, there's one thing that you said, Jim, that I wish could be applied worldwide.
If everybody could go through the experience that I went through about the after-death phenomena, boy, would this be a nicer world to live in.
Absolutely. People would then look at everybody as brothers and sisters and not be dog eat dog and help for the common good of all. James, I thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to doing this again in the future when you have another experience that we can all talk about.
God strike me dead, it's all time. I say that, I guess. Let's say nature strike me dead. That's what I believe in more than God. If I'm not telling the truth.
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. I appreciate it. You and Marissa have a great day.
Rod, I want to say one more thing.
Yes.
Rod, since we are winding this up, I feel like there's a huge weight lift off of my shoulders.
Why do you say that?
Rod, it just... You had me pretty upset here. I had to stop and compose myself a few times.
I know.
And yet now I feel... I haven't felt this feel, I don't think, ever. I can't remember. Tranquility. At peace. No weight on my shoulders.
Maybe it's because you've done what Spirit had intended you to do.
Just want to go sit down someplace and just close my eyes and put my hands across my chest.
And languish in the peace and the calm.
Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself, Rod Davis.
My friend, I wish you nothing but the best.
All right, Rod.
Hey, take care.